I'm going to be preaching on the subject of confusion or peace, your choice. And what we're going to be dealing with, particularly in the book of Acts, is the idea that Paul will run into idol and idol worship, and he'll have a thing or two to say about that, but we'll find out before I read Acts that Paul is not good for business. He's never been good for business. There is a woman who has a spirit of divination, and her owners are making a lot of money from her, and he heals the woman, and they're out, I guess, thousands of bucks. And what we're going to see in the book of Acts is that Paul is not good for the worship of Artemis in Ephesus. But let me get to an Old Testament reading, which is not what is listed. It's not a mistake, but the Old Testament is filled with anguish about idols that take the place of the God unseen, the living God who has created everything. I want to read a little bit from Isaiah 44 because I think it's very sarcastic, and Isaiah's talking about people who worship idols. And he says, the carpenter measures with a line and makes an outline with a marker. He roughs it out with chisels and marks it with compasses. He shapes this piece of wood in the form of man in all his glory, that it may dwell in a shrine. He cuts down cedars, or perhaps takes a cypress or oak. He let it grow among the trees of the forest, or planted a pine and the rain made it grow. It is man's fuel for burning. Some of it he takes, and he warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. But he also fashions a god from that same wood, and he makes an idol and bows down to it. Half of the wood he burns in the fire. Over it he prepares his meal. He roasts his meat and eats his fill. He also warms himself and says, "Ah, I am warm, I see the fire," and from the rest he makes a god, his idol. He bows down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, "Save me, you are my God." They know nothing. They understand nothing. Their eyes are plastered over so that they cannot see, and their minds are closed so that they cannot understand. Our New Testament readings, I first want to deal with the book of Acts. And our friend the Apostle Paul has returned to Ephesus, which has been his longest ministry. He spends 3 years in Ephesus. He spends a year and a half in Corinth. And in Ephesus, Ephesus is one of the great cities of what was called Asia Minor. It sits on the western coast of Turkey. And what Paul saw when he was in Ephesus was this great structure, which was the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus. It was considered by a number of people who traveled around the ancient world to be one of the seven wonders of the world. We have the Temple of Mausoleus, that's where we get our word mausoleum. We have the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. The one I really wanted to see was the Colossus of Rhodes, whose legs bestrode the harbor and was taller than the Statue of Liberty. But of all the ancient wonders of the world, do you know which is the only ancient wonder which is still standing? The pyramids. The pyramids. But according to writers, this was the greatest, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus. Her cult was located in this building. Those columns are over 60 feet high. It is nearly 500 feet in length and 250 feet in depth. Artemis was the third most popular god idol in the ancient world. Scholars have only found more temples to Jupiter, or Zeus, and to Artemis's brother Apollo. But Artemis was known as the god of fertility. And can you see, this is the statue that was in that great temple. If you see now, you look at simpler statues of Artemis, which I don't have, but if you want to, I can get you some of those. But Artemis was portrayed as a huntress, as a protector of women. Women found solace and could find refuge in the temple of Artemis at Ephesus. But as you see, she was also and mostly the god of childbirth and fecundity. So scholars don't know whether those things beneath her are multiple breasts or whether they're eggs indicating birth or new birth. But again, people would go into that temple and it would be dark and they would come forward and pay their respects to Artemis. And if you were a good follower of Artemis, you would make a journey from wherever you were. And again, her temples were scattered around the ancient world. You would come to Ephesus to worship the great idol at Artemis. And it was thought that that structure, that statue, came down from heaven and just landed there. I called it a stone, and then they put it up and erected. This building was erected in 323 BC. Alexander the Great at the time had conquered the city of Ephesus, but the people were so wealthy at that time that they told Alexander, "We'll build it ourselves. You don't have to bother. We'll build it ourselves." So this is the world that Paul came into, and Marilyn, I think there's another picture we have. One more picture. That is that, you see that column there? It's a composite column. That is the only thing that is left from the great temple to Artemis. The only thing that is left. And what archaeologists did was just take a random number of pieces from different columns and put that up. And so I want you to think of that, because I want to say something about holy places. So, with that extended introduction, hear God's word to us from the Acts of the Apostles, Luke's sequel, verse 23-32. Also, Ephesus had the biggest theater in the ancient world. 25,000 people could worship there. It was a theater first, and then it became the arena for gladiatorial events. So, about that time, there arose a great disturbance about the way. Christianity was called the way at first. A silversmith named Demetrius, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought in no little business for the craftsmen. He called them together along with the workmen in related trades and said, "Men, you know we receive a good income from making idols. And you see and hear how this fellow Paul has convinced and led astray large numbers of people here in Ephesus and in practically the whole province of Asia. He says that man-made gods are no gods at all. There is danger not only that our trade will lose its good name, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be discredited, and the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia, who is worshipped throughout the world, will be robbed of her divine majesty." When they heard this, they were furious and began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" Soon the whole city was in an uproar. The people seized Gaius, Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia, and rushed as one man into the theater, the biggest theater in the ancient world. Paul wanted to appear before the crowd, but the disciples would not let him. Even some of the officials of whom Paul was acquainted of the province, friends of Paul, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. The assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some were shouting another thing, all were shouting, and most of the people did not even know why they were shouting. The Jews pushed Alexander to the front, and some of the crowd shouted instructions to him. He motioned for silence in order to make a defense before the people. But when they realized he was a Jew, they all shouted in unison, Okay. About 2 hours they shouted, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." The city clerk quieted the crowd and said, "Men of Ephesus, doesn't all the world know that the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and of her image which fell from heaven? Therefore, since these facts are undeniable, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash." This is the word of the Lord. No, thanks be to God. And one other passage I have too. And this is from 1 Corinthians. And it's about Paul talking about what good worship is. Because in that church at Corinth, people were speaking in tongues. And when we talk about speaking in tongues, we're talking about the charismatic movement where people utter sounds that are not a language we may know, but they're sounds of ecstasy. And Corinth was filled with that sort of people, and Paul himself was a tongue speaker too. But Paul said everything in church should be done decently in order, and when you have a lot of people just speaking in tongues, it gets confusing to any outsider there is. It gets confusing to Paul, and nothing of worth is accomplished. So at the end of his talk about tongues, he says, you all have to remember that God is a God not of confusion, but of peace. Thanks be to God for his holy reading. Well, we don't want to be people of confusion. We don't want to run around, as my grandmother said, like chickens with their heads cut off. We don't want to be people who are caught in the midst of a crowd and we don't know why they're there. And we don't know why we're there. We're just shouting along with everyone else. So how do we move from confusion to peace? And throughout the New Testament, Jesus talks about the perfect peace that he asked to offer. And that word is eirene in Greek, and we get our English word irenic. And it means more than just kind of a surface peace. It's a kind of peace which percolates throughout our beings and gives us hope that wherever we are, the power and the love and the spirit of Jesus Christ go with us. Perfect peace. How do we get there from a world in state of confusion to the peace that Jesus Christ wants us to have? Well, it's pretty obvious from our texts, our last two from the New Testament, that verbal noise deflects any shaft of peace that might come our way. Verbal noise gets us confused, and it robs us of peace. So Paul begins to talk about the importance of quiet. The importance of quiet. At Ocean Grove, I was talking to a minister. I took some vacation time there, and that's a religious area on the Jersey Shore. And there was a minister I was talking to who had a huge church in Florida, and they had 3 or 4 services on Sunday, and they were all praise services and a lot of noise, wonderful acoustics. And he said, "You know, I'm thankful I'm here." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because there's not enough people around to make a lot of noise." And then he said something I thought was great. He said, "You know, I love what I do, but sometimes I wish I was a Quaker." Have you ever been to a Quaker meeting? What they do is sit around until someone gets inspired, and then they'll talk briefly and quietly. They'll close their mouths and then go back into an attitude of prayer. He said, "I love my work. I love the fact that we're attracting people and bringing them to the Lord," he said, "but sometimes I wish I was a Quaker because I'm just afraid of all that noise. It doesn't do good things to me." And you know that expression that we have, "I just need a little peace and quiet." How many of you have said that? You're looking around the world, you're looking around at people, it's a good way to shut up friends or enemies. "I just need a little peace and quiet." And in fact, so do you. "And I won't get peace and quiet unless you get peace and quiet. I just need a little peace and quiet." Where does that come from? That comes from 1 Chronicles, where God says to Israel, "You know, with the reign of Solomon, what I'm going to bestow on you is peace and quiet. All I want is peace and quiet." And what I'm saying today is the way to peace is through quietness. The way to peace is through quietness. When I was a minister many eons ago in the Mohawk Valley in a church in a town called St. Johnsville, I visited with a young woman who and her 8-year-old daughter, and they were living next to the young woman's mother. So the 8-year-old daughter had the grandmother there and her mother, and also her father continued to work in New York City and would come up on the weekends. That's a long commute. But I was saying to her, so you lived in Manhattan for a while? And she said, yeah, we decided to come up for my daughter's sake. She's doing much better in this country school. She's doing much better. And I said to her, is that because she has her grandma? And the woman said, I thought it was because she had my mother there. But she pulled me aside, my little daughter didn't. She says, well, I love grandma, but that's not why I like it up here. It's just quiet up here. It's quiet up here. I can hear myself think. And I don't remember, this was quite a while ago, whether she had ADHD or whether there was issues of anxiety. It may have been a spectrum of disorders, and Manhattan wasn't the right place for her to be. She loved her grandmother, but what she loved was the wide open space of farmland where there was verbal peace or a verbal truce. And she did very, very well. Jesus says again and again in the gospel, he tells his disciples, come by yourselves to a lonely place. And we're told in Luke that Jesus goes and prays in a lonely place. And then he goes up in the morning and he prays in a mountain in a lonely place. It's interesting that Jesus always talks about lonely places when he's alone and by himself. And I think that's the problem we have in embracing quietness, is it not? Because if we're alone and quiet, we often feel lonely, don't we? I know I often do. Now, I have an advantage because I live alone. But sometimes, particularly if I've had a hard day here, not that I have many, but once in a while, it's kind of, you know, one thing after another, and I get home, and the first thing I do is I turn on the television in the living room. Then I get up, and I turn the radio on in the kitchen. And then I go upstairs and turn the television on in the bedroom and making sure that the television and the living room are not coordinated so that there are different voices coming from different sections of the house. And I feel as if somehow I have a sense then of community. And so I think we're all afraid of being quiet. You know, it's a frightening thing. But it's so important because it's only in that way that we can experience the fullness and presence of God, I think. It's only that way that God can begin to direct our lives in the way that our Lord wants us to go. And the second thing that's so important about quiet, which brings us peace, is that quiet, if we're quiet enough, if we spend quiet time with the Lord, then we don't do rash and impulsive things. Let me say that again. If we're quiet with the Lord, if we take the time, and yeah, I know loneliness is kind of lurking. Maybe the devil's middle name is loneliness, and the devil says, no, you got to be with a lot of people now. You got to do a lot of talking. In fact, if you're not with people, I'm going to have a lot of inner chatter going on in your head. But if we can make the time and have the courage to be quiet, then I think we're not going to make rash decisions. And that's what Acts says. Alexander gets up and says, look, Paul's against idols, but he's not said anything negative about Artemis. No, by the way, that's good religion, isn't it? That we're not damning another religion, but our faith is built on the fact that we can argue with other religions and say, I care for your religion, but I'm a Christian because I think it's superior. I think that's what Paul does again and again. But again, this guy gets up and says, don't make rash decisions, which would have been killing Paul, I think. That's what he's talking about. And he says, be quiet, because if you're not quiet, you're going to do something stupid. Now, have any of you ever done something stupid? And I'm the foremost of that, my friends. I'm up here preaching not because I have it all together. I'm probably, of all of you, that has it least together. But I've done something stupid, many things stupid, and it's because of impulsivity. And that impulsivity is fueled because I'm listening to a variety of voices. Or I'm listening to the talking heads on the television or whatever telling me what I should be doing or not doing or whatever. And I don't take the time to be quiet. And if I did, I wouldn't do as many rash things as I have done in the past. Now, I think of people all the time who, they lose a loved one. They're in their 70s or 80s. And they say, well, I've lived in Hurley all my life, but I'm moving to Florida. Have you known people like that? They listen to a lot of people say, well, get away from your pain. Move to Florida, and it'll be sunny there. You can start your life over again. We can't take our troubles with us, by the way, geographically. Our troubles follow us wherever we go. And, you know, salvation comes when they come back. And they say, you know, I can live in quiet, and I won't listen to my friends as much as I love them, as much as I have listened to them in the past, because leaving Hurley in the light of my loss was a rash decision. We're not trying to indict anyone, because we've all done that sort of thing. And it betokens the idea that peace comes from quietness, and it protects us from rash decisions, whatever those decisions are. I made a rash decision this summer, but I won't tell you about it. Just quite a rash decision. I bought a third road bike this summer, and I needed a third road bike like I need a hole in the head. But that's neither here nor there. Nevertheless, we don't do stupid and unimpressive things because we are listening too much to the voices of the world. And the final thing I'd like to say is that quietness brings peace. By relativizing the present. In other words, it's very interesting, if you were to read on in Acts 20, Paul is moving from Ephesus back to Jerusalem. Well, he's going out to Macedonia. There are some rich churches out there, and he's taking an offering to go to the church in Jerusalem, the original church, which is suffering, because they're no longer included in Jewish almsgiving, and that church in Jerusalem is suffering. So Paul is taking a love package from a lot of churches there. He stops at Ephesus, meets with his followers there, and then he moves on. He moves on after he's been threatened, after he's been in this crowd and mob. You would think that the guy would say, I need to get to a hospital because I'm suffering from PTSD, but he's not suffering from that at all. He says, okay, I'm going to go to Jerusalem. Bye. I'll miss you, but I got to go. I have a bigger calling. Well, I think when we are quiet, the problems which face us in the present begin to recede in importance. And God convinces us that there are bigger issues that he's luring us toward. And we need not worry about what's going on in the present. We don't need to worry about at all. There's a wonderful book that was written by a Harvard professor called Ruination Nation. And what we talk about, Marilyn, I think you can get that one picture up. Megan K. Thomas talks about the Civil War and the fact that both sides would just level cities, would raise them, would torch them, would cannonade them. Now, many of these cities, particularly in the South, were rebuilt. But the Confederates, on two occasions, one was in Chambersburg, just made a foray up north to destroy the city just to get even. But it's very, very interesting. There were many people who looked at Europe and looked at some of the ancient ruins in Europe and said, let's not rebuild. Let's just contemplate what no longer is. Let's contemplate that chimney which was part of a huge mansion. Let's contemplate the shard of a wall that was part of a governmental structure. Let us find God in those ruins. I spent a few hours in Ephesus, an hour, maybe nearly 2 hours, I came down and just looked at that column. Because I understood that what was of so much importance in Paul's day wasn't anymore. And often what is of so much importance in my life and your life, if we just sit with it in quiet, we'll realize that it will pass. It won't be as solid as a temple, but rather the thing that exorcised us most will be like a single column. Does that make sense? That makes sense? I haven't fooled you, have I? I haven't tried to snow you in any way, right? Find a sacred place in your life. Where is it? Which shows you that all things pass and that God is in charge. Sit there quietly and thank God for the present. Thanks be to God for our victories. Amen. Please stand and greet one another this morning. Oh, shoot.